Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some stories seem too sacred, too central to let go. But my guest today says it's high time we booted a few long-held media favorites. Iconic media tales from the Spanish-American War to Hurricane Katrina that shape our sense of the world, but, he says, shouldn't. My guest, journalism professor Joseph Campbell, says we are surrounded by towering media myths that get the story wrong, from War of the Worlds to Watergate. This hour On Point, the charge of media myth and American history. You can join the conversation. Have we been misled, from bra burning to crack babies to what ended the Vietnam War? What's truth here? What about greater truth? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is W. Joseph Campbell, professor in the School of Communication at American University. He spent 20 years as a newspaper reporter and wire service reporter. His latest book is Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. W. Joseph Campbell. Joe Campbell, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
And with us this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Jack, it's great to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Campbell.
Jack, how are you?
Fine.
So Joe Campbell, talk about goring sacred cows here. I mean, you've got sort of the top of the pops. These are supposed to be the stories that by which we set our moral compass, our investigative lights, you know, from William Randolph Hearst, who may not be a paragon, nevertheless, but right on through to things we consider heroic in the media realm. Edward Murrow and Walter Cronkite and the Watergate investigation. What's a media myth? What's the form that you're chasing here?
Well, these are prominent stories about the news media, about and or by the news media, that are widely believed, often retold. We're not talking here about run-of-the-mill errors and faux pas that the mm-hmm. news media inevitably commit. We are talking about well-known stories, and these are dubious tales that often promote misleading interpretations about the news media and their power. And one of my students came up with this characterization. They can be thought of, media myths can be thought of as the junk food of journalism, just almost too good to be resisted.
But you're looking at kind of some, I mean, they are maybe junk food, but they're also icons. I mean, Ed Murrow taking on Joseph McCarthy and Joseph McCarthy seeing the end of his great Red Scare era. I mean, Walter Cronkite, you know, shaking his head at the end of the newscast and calling Vietnam a quagmire, and LBJ saying, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. Untrue? Untrue?
Yes, both of them, in both cases. I mean, Edward R. Murrow certainly was on the air in March 1954 dissecting Joseph R. McCarthy and his witch hunt in government. And Walter Cronkite in February 1968, certainly on the air in a program, a special report about Vietnam, at which during at the end of the program, he characterized the conflict there as a quagmire mm-hmm. and suggested that eventually – he said we were mired in stalemate and suggested eventually we will need to perhaps open negotiations as a way out. Those things actually happened, indeed. But the interpretation that has become attached to those and other episodes are completely false. In the case of the Cronkite moment, Lyndon Johnson did not watch the program. He did not, as often has been reported, snapped off the television set and said something to the effect of, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America, mm-hmm. or I've lost the war. Mm-hmm. Versions vary. Mm-hmm. At that moment, Lyndon Johnson was in Austin, Texas. He was at the 51st birthday party of Governor John Connally. And Johnson was trying to make light of the occasion. He was teasing Governor Connally about turning 51, saying, John, this is the age that we this is the magic number we all aim for, all politicians aim for, a simple majority. And so there's no evidence at all that Johnson saw the program later on videotape. The White House had a
He did or did not?
He did not. There is no evidence that he later saw it. And even if he did, the power of this anecdote, the power of the Cronkite moment is in the supposed immediate and decisive reaction that President Lyndon Johnson had to the program.
Well, let me just ask you, let me put the scalpel in to ask, because you may have it exactly right on the facts, and yet maybe there's some splitting of hairs as well. Could it be, I mean, did LBJ hear of this later, and maybe not publicly at a birthday party, but to his advisors say, my gosh, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the country?
He may have said that, but then you're talking about a completely different story, a completely different anecdote. As I say, the power of that anecdote is in the immediate and powerful effect that it supposedly had on Johnson, that suddenly he realized his Vietnam policy was askew, that he had to revisit that policy. But looking closely at what was going on at that period, this is the immediate aftermath of the Tet Offensive in 1968, the surprise attacks by communist North Vietnamese and their Viet Cong sympathizers throughout what was then South Vietnam. And it was a real surprise to American military personnel as well as to American politicians, including Johnson. And the end of February 1968 was a moment in which his administration set in motion a review, a top-to-bottom review of Vietnam policy.
Mm-hmm.
And that review coincided with Cronkite's declaration that we are mired in stalemate in Vietnam. But what Cronkite said had very little, if anything, to do with the administration's review of Vietnam policy in 1968.
Jack, you've been dipping into these. I want to get your view, but let's just hear that for a moment. This is February 68, same month as Joe Campbell says that there was a big review of policy. Here's Cronkite's commentary.
It seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. This summer's almost certain standoff will either end in real give-and-take negotiations or terrible escalation. And for every means we have to escalate, the enemy can match us. And that applies to invasion of the North, the use of nuclear weapons, or the mere commitment of 100 or 200 or 300,000 more American troops to the battle. And with each escalation, the world comes closer to the brink of cosmic disaster.
Cosmic disaster, Uncle Walter. But Jack Beatty, how about it? Are you buying that that was not a turning point? If LBJ didn't at that moment smack his forehead and say, my gosh, we've lost Walter, we've lost the war, is this a pernicious media myth, Jack?
Yes and no. I mean, it's a myth in that I think Joe very successfully shows Johnson never saw it and possibly never even heard of it. And there were other things going on, this review, for example, mm-hmm. That were much more central in his decision-making, his decision to call for peace talks and his decision to withdraw as a candidate for re-election, which came within the next 30 or 40 days. I mean, really, it sounds like the more important person he lost was Dean Acheson, the wise man who was telling him at the time, there isn't any future in this, Mr. President. That really seemed to get his attention. On the other hand, I can remember that and the effect on people who were against the war looked at that as a threshold moment, because here was the most trusted man in America in the most mainstream medium. This wasn't the New Yorker. This wasn't the Nation. This wasn't the New Republic or the New York Review, which had been saying these things
right.
really for years. Mm-hmm. This was CBS, and this was Walter Cronkite. And the effect on the climate of opinion of that, I can't measure it. But just remembering it, I thought it legitimated and made respectable war protest and the idea and the notion that it was futile and why are we doing it? And even in the broadcast, he gave an out for people who didn't want to seem anti-American. He said, "We're an honorable people. We've tried the best we mm-hmm. can." Mm-hmm. And so I agree that maybe it didn't have this effect on Johnson. It surely had some large effect on consolidating a mood that was already sort of inchoate.
So, Joe Campbell, then do we have a pernicious media myth here or kind of an apocryphal tipping point that was, in fact, in its own way important? Or how do you look at it?
I don't see this the Cronkite moment as a tipping point at all. Mark Kurlansky wrote quite a good book about 1968, a year study, in which he said Cronkite's view was hardly a radical position for the time. And he's quite right. The New York Times, several months before, in the summer of 1967, had on its front page written that the war in Vietnam was not going very well. In fact, it looks like a stalemate.
But they weren't in everybody's living room every night.
Well, the New York Times can, in many respects, help set the agenda. And just a few days before the Cronkite program, the Wall Street Journal was saying that the war effort in Vietnam may be doomed and everybody had better get ready for the bitter taste of defeat. I mean, these were more aggressive and targeted characterizations. Cronkite's, if you listen very closely to his closing editorial, he really fudges it in some respects, giving negotiations a chance, but maybe we should wait a little bit further to see what the outcome of the summer offensive might be.
And the downside of having this stand as a myth is what? How would you define it, the problem with it?
Well, there are many reasons that media myths are pernicious and deserve to be debunked. Mm-hmm. And one of them is that give the news media far more power and influence than they really deserve and then they really do wield. The Cronkite moment, for example, is often cited as an example of how the news media have suddenly and demonstrably changed opinion in America and at the highest levels of American government. And that's just really not true. Public opinion had begun shifting against the war in Vietnam many months before the Cronkite moment. And there was a whole series of Gallup polls that point to this, that a plurality of Americans by October 1967 had thought the war in Vietnam had become a mistake. So there were other forces and factors at work here, far more important and far more powerful than a one-hour television broadcast late at night on February 27th, 1968.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about great media stories, media myths, my guest says, in American history. 10 beloved stories that W. Joseph Campbell says got the real story wrong. His new book is Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. And here's the sound of one of them, October 1938, a radio adaptation of War of the Worlds, directed by Orson Welles, supposedly led to widespread panic when listeners mistook the program for a real news broadcast and assumed that an actual alien invasion was taking place. Here's a little clip. A fictional reporter is wiped out by a Martian heat ray.
What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, as far as the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill.
Okay, there's a little bit of the radio broadcast. Joe Campbell, I'm looking here in your book at the headlines. Radio fake scares nation, did it not?
There were, Tom, some people who were frightened by the Orson Welles radio dramatization of the War of the Worlds in October 1938. But overwhelmingly, most listeners realized what that program was. It was good radio. It was good entertainment. It was a Sunday night mm-hmm. program, and it was in the regular time slot for Orson Welles' famous radio program and Mercury Theater on the air. And the surveys that were done after the fact revealed that most people really thought that this was great entertainment. Very few people comparatively thought that this was a real event. And there is no evidence, absolutely no evidence, of nationwide panic or mass hysteria having been caused by this program.
So what do you reckon happened here? A few people were freaked out by it, and that was kind of a satisfying tale to tell, and so it was repeated until it became a national hysteria?
That's partly the case, I think. Keep in mind, the program was aired at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on a Sunday, the Sunday before Halloween. And newspaper newsrooms at that hour, particularly thin-staffed. And suddenly, at about 8:20, 8:30 that evening, newspapers began getting phone calls from viewers, from listeners, and wondering what the heck is going on. And this was a natural response. Happens often that at least it did then, that radio audiences would telephone newspapers or police stations or other authorities just to find out what indeed is actually happening. And they did this in great numbers in the aftermath of the War of the Worlds and during the program, actually. A lot of the newsrooms seized upon these calls as evidence of widespread people being upset across the country, of mass panic and hysteria. And the Associated Press contributed to this. They, in their fashion, put together a roundup of stories from anecdotes from across the country that served the purpose of giving a sense, of offering a sense that this was a widespread mass hysteria, when it really was very, very situational. And as I say, some people were frightened, but the fright didn't last very long.
Yeah. Jack, what do you think here? The kind of irresistible takeaway in that sleepy Sunday night newsroom that we're a nation of silly ninnies, and some destructive legacy in that? Or is this just a good old tale magnified?
I think probably the latter. I mean, I'm struck with one point you make here, Joe, that the newspapers had a vested interest here in putting down what they call terror by radio. It was a rival medium. And they were magnifying the claims for terror to show, look at how irresponsible this medium is. At the same time, they were being irresponsible.
Radio's dangerous. We're not.
That's right.
But in a way, all the press basks here, as in many of these instances, in the kind of power of the press, the idea that they could tell a story and have people running out of their shower stalls screaming or whatever.
Including a couple of Princeton professors who apparently went down to Grover's Mills just as they heard the broadcast to check out the reports. Now, these are hardly what you would call candidates for credulity.
But Joe Campbell won't give them mass hysteria. Joe, take us back to the tale in your list of 10. And this is William Randolph Hearst and the Spanish-American War, the sort of you supply the pictures, I'll furnish the war, apocryphal, you say, exchange.
Yes, it's one of the great stories in American journalism. It's perhaps American journalism's best-known single anecdote, how William Randolph Hearst brought about the Spanish-American War in 1898. And the anecdote about his vow to furnish the war is often cited as Exhibit A in the lineup of evidence that supposedly says that, yes, Hearst was the warmonger. He brought about the Spanish-American War.
And he supposedly was telegraphing here Frederick Remington, the great illustrator who was on assignment in Cuba, and there wasn't, as it goes, much going on, and he was getting frustrated with, painting Cuban scenes. And what the tale is that Hearst sent him this telegram saying what exactly?
Well, Remington sent, supposedly, the anecdote, the story has mm-hmm. it, that Remington sent Hearst a telegram saying, everything is quiet, there will be no war, I wish to return. Mm-hmm. This would have been, if it happened, it would have been in January 1897, about 15 months before the Spanish-American War began. Mm-hmm. Hearst, in reply, supposedly said, please remain, you furnish the pictures, and I'll furnish the war. There's lots of reasons to doubt that this ever happened, that this exchange of telegrams ever took place. Hearst, for one thing, denied it. Remington apparently never spoke publicly about it because it wasn't important at that time. The telegrams themselves, the artifacts, have never turned up. Spanish censors controlled all incoming and outgoing telegraphic traffic at that time in Cuba. And had they seen a message like this from William Randolph Hearst vowing to furnish the war, the Spanish authorities certainly would have seized on this telegram as an example of Yankee meddling. And if it had happened, it certainly would have been that case.
Is there a greater truth here? I mean, he did have Remington down there to give drama, I suppose, the drama of his talent visually to the scene in Cuba. And his newspapers did famously sort of a cheerlead for war.
Well, the greater truth was the rebellion that was going on in Cuba that had begun in February 1895 and finally in 1898 gave rise to what we know as the Spanish-American War. But this rebellion was a nasty island-wide insurrection, really, guerrilla warfare in many respects, to which the Spanish had sent 200,000 troops in a failed attempt to try to put down this rebellion. And the Cubans were fighting for their political independence, and they were not going to give up anything short of that. And that was the nasty little conflict that was going on at the time Remington went to Cuba, assigned by Hearst. Remington was accompanied by another journalist named Richard Harding Davis, who became American journalism's best-known war correspondent in the Spanish-American War and later in World War I, the early days of World War I. And So they were there to cover a war. And the content of Hearst's purported telegram to Remington, "You furnish the pictures and I'll furnish the war," makes no sense. Makes no sense. It's incongruous on its face, because why would Hearst have said, "I will furnish the war," when war was the very reason he sent Remington and Richard Harding Davis to Cuba in the first place?
But boy, oh boy, did these things burrow in and become a deep part of our view of the world. Let's go to our callers. Leah in Burlington, Vermont. Leah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Leah?
Well, I work in higher education, and one of the things that I was noticing as we were having this conversation and I was hearing the broadcast is just the amount of media myths that so many students come to college with. And I would argue that these are educational media myths, myths that they get from inaccurate textbooks, from certain lectures they may have taken in high school. And then we have to re-educate them in what may have actually occurred once they come to a college or university setting. And I just wanted to shed that perspective on the whole conversation, because these myths continue because there are other sources of media that are really being influential to children.
So do you fight them, Leah, or do you surrender? I mean, once they're implanted, you know, here we just cited one that's been around for more than a century. Can you win that battle?
I think the struggle, too, is also showing students where someone is actually benefiting from a story being told a certain way, and showing them how that does make sense. And then they may, you know, start to understand a little better, wait a minute, yeah, this story being told in this way actually benefits a certain party, and it doesn't quite make sense. And I think when they see the logic and the logic's exposed to them in that way, you know, and they are given the facts, I feel that it does, I feel like it is possible to fight. In fact, there's a great book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. I believe it's authored by someone named Lowen, and it's a fantastic accompaniment to breaking down some of these myths.
It sounds like you're pretty sharply on top of them, Leah. Thanks for your call. Joe Campbell, I mean, there's the teacher fighting the tide, but she asked her students to think about who wins from particular stories. I mean, take the Hearst story. Who wins from that? Who's benefiting, if it's not true, by the untruth?
Yeah, that was Leah's question and comment were quite good. And when she was referring to a great book, I thought she was going to talk about mine, but...
Getting it wrong. 10 of the greatest.
But seriously, she's right. I think you really do have to recognize that these myths are really ingrained, and they are taught at not only the college level, but in secondary schools and in junior high. I mean, they really are embedded, many of them. And the Hearst myth is one of the most embedded myths of journalism history. I think it's important to recognize how they arise, where do they come from? And I think there are at least three quick answers to that question as to where they come from. One is they often offer very simplistic, straightforward answers to complex historical issues. How the United States entered the war in Cuba against Spain is a complex historical question that historians continue more than a century later to argue about. And the Hearst anecdote, "You furnish the pictures and I'll furnish the war," is a very simplistic answer to a complex question. Well, the war began because Hearst riled up the public opinion and forced the country into a war it didn't want. It's a simplistic answer to a complex issue. Another factor is that these stories, some of them, and Hearst is one example, "The War of the Worlds" is another. These stories are sometimes too good, too delicious not to be true. Too good to be checked out in some respects. And I was going to say that a third factor is the fact that these myths tend to, for journalists, be self-reverential. They suggest a power that the news media often do not have. The news media power is there. It's certainly a powerful force in a country, but media power tends to be trumped by other more important and more powerful forces and factors.
I think there's nothing stronger here than your examples. You take on the bra burning, a sort of an iconic notion, and I guess the assertion is event in 1960s. History, and you say there's a myth as well. What is it?
Well, the bra burning myth says that at the Miss America pageant in September 1968, about 100 or so feminist protesters protesting the pageant itself as is degrading to women, demonstratively and flamboyantly burned their bras on the boardwalk at Atlantic City in a demonstration to call attention to the degrading nature of the Miss America pageant. That was their argument. The notion of bra burning was propelled by a couple of syndicated newspaper columnists, including Art Buchwald, who was the leading American humor journalist of the time.
And you're not saying it didn't happen in Atlantic City. You've got the photos here, September 7, 1968.
The photos don't show any bra burning.
Oh.
It's a nuanced myth, though,
I'm
Tom.
Looking at it, trying to find the flame. Okay, what's the nuance here?
The nuance is that the press of Atlantic City, the local newspaper in Atlantic City, the day after the demonstration on the boardwalk at Atlantic City, reported that, yes, bras were burned, as well as other things that the protesters had tossed into this freedom trash can.
Mm-hmm.
And they tossed high-heeled shoes, copies of Playboy, Cosmopolitan, other so-called instruments of torture for women.
Yeah, there's a photo of a gallon of girdle going in there, it looks like.
There you go. And but the feminists have long argued that bras were not burned at Atlantic City. Robin Morgan, who headed the protest that day, has insisted for years that there were no bras burned at Atlantic City. In my research, though, I came across this newspaper article in the Atlantic City newspaper. And my God, that was one of the moments in researching the book that I just couldn't believe. I mean, I had to reread that article three or four times to believe what I was seeing. And that said that bras were burned there.
So?
So it turns out that if bras were burned at Atlantic City at all, it was a very modest, brief kind of demonstration. It was a flamboyant, twirling the burning bra over your head kind of demonstration. It was more of a smoldering, if you will.
So you're saying the myth is that there was a wave of bra burnings across this country, and you say no.
That's right. That's right. The bra burning 1960s or 1970s, as those periods are often referred to, they were not characterized by bra burning in any event.
Jack, is this splitting hairs? I mean, if the paper said there were, if there was one, is it you know, pernicious myth to talk about the fact? It clearly had symbolic weight to people. It's a phrase that everybody knows.
Yes, and I think there's where the significance lies. It was used to put down women's liberation, as it was called at the time. Women were made to seem silly and petty because they were doing this, and foolish. And you mentioned Art Buchwald. Well, of course, he was a humorist, and he gave that view currency. And I think it caught on because of that. It was a very convenient handle to put down the effort of women to reach equality in America. On the other hand, there was also a sort of truth in it, too, which is that many women stopped wearing bras around then. I mean, that's just a demonstrable fact. Now, the one thing didn't cause the other, but it was part of a climate of opinion of, we are not going to, you know, be dressed by the fashion industry. We are not going to be dictated to by men. We are going to achieve our own in our own way, and so on. So I think it's a complicated story, but that was used as a butt, as a way to put women down.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about great media stories, media myths, my guest says, in American history. 10 beloved stories that W. Joseph Campbell says got the story wrong. He's collected them in his new book, Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. He says it's pernicious. We take the wrong lessons. We get manipulated. We end up with the wrong understanding of the world if we don't have the facts. What do you hear in Joe Campbell's debunkings? Watergate is a huge one. Let's listen to just a little bit from there was the 1974 book, All the President's Men, recounting Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. They're reporting on Watergate. Of course, the myth, Joe Campbell says, that it took down Richard Nixon. In this scene, Robert Redford, as Bob Woodward, demands that informant Deep Throat Hal Holbrook tell him everything.
I need to know what you know. It was a Haldeman operation. The whole business was run by Haldeman, the money, everything. It won't be easy getting at him. He was insulated. You'll have to find out how. Mitchell started doing covert stuff before anyone else. The list is longer than anyone can imagine. It involves the entire U.S. intelligence community, FBI, CIA, Justice. It's incredible. Cover-up had little to do with Watergate. It was mainly to protect the covert operations. It leads everywhere.
It leads everywhere. Okay, Joe Campbell, talk about sacred ground. What are you saying is myth and fact in the Watergate story?
Well, quite simply, the reporting of the Washington Post in 1972 did not bring down Richard Nixon. Even the newspaper, even the Post, and its some of its top officials and figures there, from time to time, have scoffed at this notion that it was the Post and the reporting of Woodward and Bernstein that took down Richard Nixon's corrupt presidency. Howard Kurtz, a few years ago, wrote quite clearly, despite the mythology, the Post didn't force Nixon from office. Catherine Graham, who was the publisher of the Post at the time of Watergate, also challenged that notion quite correctly and quite directly. Nixon's...
But they broke the whole thing open. Doesn't that count? I mean, are you saying it was... No, it wasn't that. It was the hearings, and then it was the legal threat, and then it was the tapes. But isn't there a kind of a, you know, I don't know, role of origin here in getting this thing going?
The fall of Richard Nixon was the consequence of his own criminal conduct and those of his close advisors. And newspapers may have contributed, but they were hardly a decisive factor in the outcome of Watergate.
What would you call the decisive factor then, if we're going to try and get down to, you know, this is it, not that? Then what was it? What was the factor?
I think Richard Nixon would have served out his second term in office as president if not for the recordings of the conversations that he made in the Oval Office, those secret tape recordings, the secret Oval Office tapes. Those tapes captured his guilty role in authorizing the cover-up of the Watergate scandal, the break-in at the Watergate complex in 1972. And without those tapes, I'm pretty sure that Nixon, at least that's my guess, it's my interpretation, that he would have served out his presidency. He would have been a weakened president, by all means, but he would have not been forced from office. But in addition, and it was the U.S. Supreme Court, finally, in the summer of 1974, that forced the disclosure by Nixon of those tapes, those smoking gun tapes. There were two special prosecutors, at least one determined federal judge. There were bipartisan House and Senate committees. There were people inside the White House, John Dean, who turned on the president. There were a lot of forces and factors at work here. And to boil it down to one newspaper and two intrepid reporters, their work was great, mind you. They won a Pulitzer Prize for the reporting about Watergate. But it wasn't the factor. It wasn't decisive in the outcome of the scandal.
But Jack Beatty, nobody believes Woodward and Bernstein sort of frog-marched Richard Nixon out of the White House. No one's saying that they, you know, those stories ran and he walked out the next morning. I mean, is this just media showboating to give them that kind of, you know, primal credit?
I think there's a lot of that. It's self-congratulations. You know, we did it. You know, how powerful are we? Well, we got rid of a president, and that seems to be part of the momentum behind this. That the media keeps repeating this.
But you think it all would have happened if it wasn't rolled out there in black and white and in print? I mean, yes, many other things happened, but would they have if it wasn't for that kind of investigation? Help me, Jack. These guys got me into the business in the first place. Come on. This is the story that drew me and a lot of other journalists in.
Well, you know, Joe, even you concede that they kept the story alive and sort of invented it. I mean, they're the first ones who looked into the break-in beyond the immediate facts. And in that summer of 1972, you quote people at the Post saying we were all alone. We were wondering were these guys just making it up? No one else was out there, and you just the the gain of that, I mean, the importance of that, of holding the torch of being the newspaper out there alone, surely that mattered, if not decisively, then very importantly in getting other newspapers to follow and in creating a climate of opinion that finally did help bring the president down.
What do you say, Joe?
That's part of the mythology. The Washington Post was not alone on the Watergate story in the summer and fall of 1972. The New York Times was out there on this on the story. The Los Angeles Times was out there too. Even Walter Cronkite at the end of October 1972 did a two-part series on the evening news about Watergate and trying to put this scandal, this complex scandal, into some sort of perspective. But the climate of opinion was such that Watergate didn't matter. Not then, it didn't. Because in early November 1972, Richard Nixon won a 49-state landslide. If Watergate had had, at least at that time, had had such an impact on the American public, you would have expected the landslide that Nixon won over George McGovern would have been substantially less. You know, Tom, at the outset of this segment, you played a portion of the famous All the President's Men movie. And that's a great scene. It's a well-chosen scene. But I think it also contributes to the mythology, too. Watergate was such a complex, sprawling scandal with all sorts of tangles and dead ends and you know, criminality here and there and everywhere in the White House. It's so complex that people these days, many years removed from it, it's hard to keep it all straight. You know, who was Haldeman? Who was Ehrlichman? Even then, in the 70s, it was hard to keep that straight.
Well, a lot of people knew an awful lot about that story, though. Then
the high-quality cinematic treatment of the Watergate scandal, featuring Woodward and Bernstein in the Washington Post and All the President's Men, does happen to be the way that many people remember the Watergate scandal. Ah, it's the reporters. It was this movie. And the movie's a great movie. And I think it helps to solidify the notion that the Post, the Washington Post, and Woodward and Bernstein were at the center, were at the heart of this, of uncovering the scandal.
And again, is that a bad thing? Is this somehow history that warps or undercuts us as a democracy or media consumers going forward if it's bogus history?
I think it absolutely is the case. I mean, one of the values of debunking myths is to the extent that you can, correct the historical record. And as I mentioned, the Post over the years has tried from time to time to do this themselves. Mentioned Katharine Graham. Bob Woodward has said, the notion that the press brought down.
Don't give it all to us. We got a lot of comments and callers here. Joe, let's go to Phil in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Phil, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I listen to you almost every day.
Great. What do you think today, Phil?
I think the professor's got too much time on his hands. I lived through most of that, the Watergate and the Vietnam War, and I think he's underestimating the persuasive attitude that Walter Cronkite had on this country. You know, at the time there were only the three networks, and you know, everybody's opinion turned on what Walter Cronkite thought.
So you think it matters if he said, you know, it's essentially it's a quagmire, we're mired in stalemate. You think that mattered?
I think it does because, you know, at the time, you know, Americans, most of us are normally, we're patriotic, whether we're Democrats or Republicans. And to hear Walter Cronkite, you know, say that out loud on the air meant a lot to America at the time. And you know, even here in Kentucky, where it's very conservative, you know, we were aware of that and the bra burning. And I also dispute that because, you know, way back in Kentucky, we heard of way too many bra burnings for him to demean that and say that it didn't happen. So I'll just, you know.
Hey, Phil, let me ask you, was it different from the pundits and commentators and media people out there today? I mean, we've still got plenty, you know, there's... you name it. There's all kinds of commentators today. Was Cronkite?
Exactly. And I think you know. Let's just think about the fringe white right wing. They listen to Glenn Beck like he you know wrote the gospel, and that's the way generally most people in America at the time, because we weren't you know as divided back then as we are nowadays. And Walter Cronkite, you know, he was the man when it came to talk around the water cooler or whatever back then.
You could sway opinion. Phil, I appreciate your call and you being out there every day. Let me get one more right here. Gary, Nashville, Tennessee. Gary, you're on.
Hey, Tom. Appreciate the opportunity. I have a little bit different observation regarding this. I was 16 at the time in 1968. It was such a traumatic year in many respects, but I disagree with the last caller. And Cronkite was important, but to me, at least anecdotally, what I recall was the unrelenting reporting of the war by the media, which had a mini-station at the cross effect. I think it was the continual reporting as opposed to any one commentary and seminal event of Cronkite.
Of the death toll and the bodies coming home, which in those days we saw again and again and again?
Yes, the body count specifically. As a young man, as a young boy, then I remember the body counts. Daily. And I was a history major in college, had a wonderful professor, Richard Marius, who went on to Harvard, and he talked about the shining of memory. And I think, as the professor has indicated, so many of these things do sort of become shined with time and memory to obviously justify a position. I think the importance of the press in terms of the war cannot be discounted, and I think was extremely important because it was a new day in terms of that type of reporting.
So you give more credit to the reporting itself, the unrelenting reporting on the body count. And Gary, I appreciate that. Let me get one more here. Exeter, Rhode Island, and Chris, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
The word complexity was used to describe truth. And I would agree with that and suggest the sort of inevitability and utility of myths as a kind of shorthand, that you can get the facts wrong but communicate something about the essential truth of the situation. And that's how we, in a practical way, understand truth and manipulate it both. And I have an example. If you remember Admiral Farragut in the Civil War with the famous quote, you know, damn the torpedoes, full through the head.
Right.
Apparently, what he actually said was, damn, pause, the torpedo.
But that wouldn't buck us up, would it?
We had our instant hero change the comma, and we had the hero we needed.
Chris, you're a good storyteller. But that is a really interesting point. Joe Campbell, you know, Chris says, well, let's think about the inevitability and the utility of myths. You're looking at them maybe from the, well, maybe you wouldn't argue that they're inevitable. You've got them piled up here. But do you grant utility or not?
Well, obviously there's some utility in media-driven myths. They do help to make the media seem to be powerful entities in a society that looks for explanations for what's going on. I do think, though, that media myths tend to be the media power tends to be overstated. There's a fine economist for and columnist for Newsweek named Robert Samuelson, and he's made the fine observation that because the media are everywhere, they surround us everywhere, we tend to grant them more power than they really deserve. And I think that that's a telling observation. I do think that close examination of these stories will reveal a better version of the truth. And in the Cronkite moment, for example, he made that declaration about mired in stalemate in February 1968. It wasn't until a little more than 5 years later when the last U.S. combat troops were withdrawn from Vietnam. If Cronkite's declaration had had such powerful effect, we would have expected to have seen the withdrawal of American forces from Vietnam.
Well, I don't know. I would straight up disagree with that, having lived through that. You know, it was such a huge issue. It was going to take a lot of time no matter what. And heaven knows there was a lot of yelling on the other side of that peak.
But Jack, 5 years is quite a long time
but you must remember how deeply entrenched. Yeah, but it wasn't like we were just twiddling our thumbs there. And people were fighting in the streets to get out of there right up until 1972. What about the shorthand comment, Jack, that our caller makes? I mean, how do we remember history without shorthand? All of history is complex. We can't all carry the entire textbook in our minds. There's going to be shorthand.
We have to do it, but you know what does Saint Matthew say? Make sure that your light, you know, walk according to the best light ye have, but make sure your light is not darkness. And that can happen. That the light, the myth we're using, can be not just wrong factually, wrong perniciously in the way that our Leah was talking about, that serving other interests. So by even repeating it, we're sort of giving legitimacy to them. You know, I think a fine example of Chris's point is the spitting idea. We just heard this. The veterans were spat on when they came home from Vietnam. Richard Blumenthal just said this in Connecticut. The Senate candidate there mentioned that. Well, as I understand this, Joe, no historian has been able to find a case of this, and yet the larger truth is clearly there. Right,
and we've had listeners, Jack, writing in and saying, "Wait a darn minute! You know that I had that experience, or you know,
well,
my brother, cousin,
right.
You fill it in the blank."
And the larger truth was they were treated terribly, and they were blamed for the war, even if they weren't spat on.
Hey, Joe, the path to Iraq is not in your list of 10 media myths, and I wondered why.
No, but
not.
there might be a sequel to this book, and
WMD, not here, not at the moment.
Well, you know, did the press fail in reporting the run-up to the Iraq War? That's a good question. It might be a subject for a chapter in a future book.
Ah, postscript could be coming. Joe Campbell, thanks very much for being with us. The book is Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Tom, thank you. Thank you, Jack.
Jack, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Before we go, a note, NBA Finals open tonight, Lakers-Celtics again. You can listen back to our show on their classic rivalry, our interview with Celtics great Bill Russell, and get a special blog reminiscence at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.